Aloha, boys and girls. You are listening to Inside the Desert Oasis Room, episode number 54. This episode is sponsored by Tandawai Rum. Established in the Philippines in 1854, Tandawai is one of the world's largest rum producers and winner of over 170 international medals in the past four decades, including Brand of the Year in London's World Branding Awards rum category from 2015 to 2017 and Rum Brand Champion of the World by thespiritsbusiness.com in 2015. As sponsor of the Inside the Desert Oasis Room podcast and the toast to Master Ninja Ray Buen at the legendary Tiki T in Los Angeles, California, Tandawai is the perfect companion to celebrate all things tiki. For more information, check out their webpage at tandawaiusa.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram at tandawaiusa. This podcast is also sponsored by the Royal Hawaiian. Founded in Laguna Beach, California in 1947, the Royal Hawaiian is South Orange County's premier tropical drink and dining destination. Come try their signature cocktail, the Lapu Lapu, a delicious combination of tropical fruit juices with a generous float of dark spirits. Or other island-inspired favorites like ahi tuna poke or the dynamite crab-crusted mahi mahi. Enjoy their delicious brunch or drop in for happy hour from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. daily for drink specials and more. To make a reservation, visit royalhawaiianlb.com. On this episode, we speak with mug maker Henrik Van Ryzin, also known as Van Tiki. Henrik was born and raised on the Hawaiian island of Oahu, and about a year ago relocated from the warm waters of the Pacific Ocean to the colder climes of the Pacific Northwest in Oregon. He shares stories about his early struggles in the art industry, how he got into tiki mug making, what it was like running the number one Airbnb in Hawaii, why he left the islands, and more. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as we did bringing it to you. This podcast is a grassroots effort, so I appreciate all the love and support you've given us recently. I can't thank you enough for that. Okay, let's get into this. Here he is, Henrik Van Ryzin, the man behind Van Tiki.
Hello.
Aloha.
Hey, aloha. How's it going?
Going good. How are you?
Not bad. Not bad.
Well, let me start by saying thank you for joining me today.
It is my pleasure.
You're in the middle of a move right now?
Yeah, huge move. Well, it's a big slow move, I would call it. I mean, we moved here, a little over a year to Oregon, but I've been living in my brother's house. He's been kind enough to let me live in his house.
Okay.
While we build a house next door to my brother.
Is it right next door?
It is right next door, yes.
So I guess he was okay with having you around.
Yeah, well, we moved together. We both left Hawaii at the same time.
Oh, and, you were living there with your brother, or was he had his own place also in Hawaii?
He had his own place. We all, my entire ohana, we sold my parents, my brother and his family. He's got a wife and three kids, and Denise, my wife, and I, all three groups sold our houses and moved out here.
So
what an insane leap.
Wow. So let's talk about Hawaii, because, you know, I think that that's a dream for a lot of people, is to live in Hawaii.
I know. It's funny. Let me back up. Well, I was born in Hawaii. That's my hometown. I grew up there. I was born and raised in Hawaii. So
I've
lived in Hawaii. Yeah, I've been there for about 35 years.
And you don't even sound like it.
I know. Dude, people, I swear, I would like meet people in Hawaii, like, and they're like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, Kailua, the same town you are. He's like, no, really, where are you from? I'm like,
you sound like somebody who said, you know what, I want to live on a tropical island, so I'm going to make changes in my life, and I'm just going to go. And
yeah.
Because you don't have the accent. You don't have the local
twang.
I know. Twang,
I don't speak pigeon. I know. It's terrible. I love pigeon. It's funny. You know what? Last night, I had a dream that went on for hours, and it was all in pigeon. And I woke up like, oh, I miss pigeon so much.
Yeah.
And it was weird. That's the first time I've ever dreamed in pigeon. Like, it was awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, if you live there for 35 years, that's the first time you dreamt in pigeon. That's pretty interesting. Yeah.
It is weird. Yeah. In fact, the whole dream was about poke, sashimi, and pigeon English.
Yeah.
Things so, I miss the most.
Did you grow up speaking pigeon at all?
No, I didn't. I'm such a nerdy, geeky kid. My dad moved to Hawaii the year before I was born. My mom and dad moved to Hawaii. And he's an ocean engineer.
Okay.
And he started his own company out there. And fun tiki trivia fact, his office was actually TC's office on Hawaii 5.0.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah, it was unreal. So as a kid, they'd come down there and shoot all the time, like for the first three seasons, anytime it took place at TC's office. And then eventually their budget got so big, they built like a duplicate of my dad's office. But uh-huh. It was out on a pier, like an ocean pier out in Waimanalo. I don't know if you're familiar with that side of the island.
Yes, I am.
So it's like by Sea Life Park, there's that big research pier out there out on the ocean. And that was my dad's office. So,
oh, how cool is that?
Oh, it was unreal. I pretty much grew up on that pier. I loved it. It was such a neat place. Like, I mean, talk about your dad having a cool office. It was pretty neat.
Is he still over there?
No, he retired. Maybe about, I don't know. Well, it was kind of a soft retirement, if you will. It was his company, so he kind of sold it, and then he was stayed on as kind of like an advisory thing for a long time.
Right.
I think he had a hard time retiring.
Yeah.
But he moved out here with us, so he's officially cut the cord.
Wow, so everybody went to Oregon.
I know. Every time I say it, I know it sounds insane.
That's got to be. Well, you know what? So I had a thought about that because Jerry Lopez, I'm sure you know who Jerry Lopez is if you were born and raised in Hawaii. Jerry Lopez moved to Bend, Oregon.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Oregon is sucking all the Hawaii people out. And I can tell you why. Because we want some elbow room.
Okay. Well, okay. So, and Jerry Lopez, for the people that don't know, which I can't imagine that nobody would know who he is, he's known as the King of Pipeline. And, you know, he was North Shore his whole life. And then now he's making surfboards, I believe, right? And snowboarding.
Well, snowboarding is so big up there in Bend. That's like the thing, I guess.
Yeah. I mean,
Bend is beautiful, but it's a little chilly.
I think he's still making surfboards.
Probably. They have tons of... That's a huge community up there.
And Bend, Oregon is landlocked. And so you
yeah,
got these
no
guys
kidding.
Making surfboards out there. But he, I know
like
that he's snowboarding
altitude.
All the time. Yeah, yeah. So is it really a popular place for Hawaiians to transplant themselves?
It is. It is so weird. Well, okay, so the weird thing was, like, it took us about a year to plan the move, and, like, firstly, it was, like, top secret. Like, nobody tell anybody. Like, we were, like, planning it, like, internally with the family. Like, oh, we might be moving, but, you know, we don't want to tell employers or anything like that, so let's just keep it on the down low.
Right.
And then finally, like, we kind of, like, came out of the closet about, you know what, I think we're going to be moving to Oregon. And then, like, all of these acquaintances of mine, oh, really, I'm moving to Oregon, too, or, oh, my friend's moving to Oregon. And, like, what? It was bizarre. It's like, there's like, I think there's like three states that Hawaii folks gravitate towards. There's mm-hmm. Vegas, Nevada, mm-hmm. and then Alaska and Oregon. And I don't know why like Alaska and Oregon are just the Pacific Northwest. I have a theory.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because it's temperate. Like it doesn't get ridiculous cold here.
Okay.
It's super green and there's no people here.
Yeah. Well, Oregon's beautiful. I know the Vegas thing, and the explanation that I was told was that it's because it's the same industry, right? It's a tourism industry.
It's super, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
So people transition their jobs, you know, just from one place to another. They're doing the same thing. Alaska, I'm not really sure why, but I know that there's a lot
yeah.
of Hawaiians up there. And, you know, a lot of the Hawaiian musicians, they tour through Alaska.
Which, right. Yeah.
Which is, it just seems like so far away from the islands, you know, and it's just so different. Maybe that's also why people go. But your reason?
Well,
yeah, your motivation.
Well, okay. So it's funny. So like I said, it's all three family groups. We all have like different motivation for coming out here. For me, it was business driven for one. Like, you know, I've lived so I grew up in Hawaii. After high school, I went to Illinois for college. I met my wife, and we both wanted to work in Hollywood. That was like our dream. That was our lifelong dream.
Mm-hmm.
So we graduated, hopped on a train, took to LA, and worked in LA for almost all of the 90s. I was in LA as a special effects artist, and my wife was an editor. And it was great. We had a blast. Okay. But the weird thing was, is every time we'd go back home and visit my parents in Hawaii, I would be like, man, Hawaii is really nice.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when you're living in LA, it's like, wow. And, you know, when I was like a 17-year-old kid, like, I'm like, I got to get off this rock, you know, like,
right.
I was all ready to get out of there. But then every time I'd visit, I'm like, dude, did I make a mistake? It's pretty nice out here.
Yeah.
So in LA is the film industry is a pretty crazy industry. And so I was looking at like my long term prospects in that industry. And a lot of the guys I worked with are like super bitter guys, but they're all great guys. I miss them all terribly.
Yeah.
But the film industry, like, you know, you work a year on a film project and then the film comes out and you're like, oh God, I can't even watch this movie. It's so bad.
Tired of looking at it, right?
Yeah, or it would be just a terrible film. Like, how, like, I'm like, why? Come on, our monster looks great, but this movie is garbage. But you know, you still get occasional, like, awesome projects. But at any rate, the big drag of working in LA is I never saw Denise, my wife. She was an editor and she worked ridiculous hours. And then half the year I'd be off on location on film sets. And so we would never see each other. Even when we were both in LA, my hours, my shop hours would be like 6 a.m. to 4 in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
I'd come home, I'd putter around, or I'd go to bed at, you know, 10 or whatever. She'd come home at like 1 or 2 in the morning. I'd wake up early to go to work. She'd be sleeping. So the only time I'd ever see her, she's just asleep.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And I'm like, this is, and that was for years. And we never took vacations. It was a crazy thing. So anyways, we're like, let's press the reset button on the life, you know what I mean? And do something totally different. So Hawaii was looking really good to us. We're like, man, it would be kind of cool to move back to Hawaii and try to make a go of it there. A couple other things, but we wanted to like totally have an adventure. We're like, we've been just nose to the grindstone in LA for so long. Let's just totally do something crazy. At that time, the Lord of the Rings films were accruing up.
Uh-huh.
And so I put my name into the hat for that. And also when we graduated from college, we thought of teaching English in Japan for a while.
Okay.
But we didn't do it. We're like, no, career first. We should do that first. But
that would have been a great adventure though, huh?
It would have. And so we're like, maybe we should do it. So we said, okay. So we sent out applications for that too. Yeah. Or like whatever comes in first, Lord of the Rings or Japan, that's what we're doing. And so Lord of the Rings kept getting greenlit and then it was getting canceled. There's like some like legal battle over the rights to the book or something. I don't know. But Japan company said, hey, we'll hire you. So we sold everything that we owned and hopped on a train or an airplane and flew to Japan and lived there for almost 2 years, which was super cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we're like, okay, Hawaii. So then we went back to Hawaii and we were there for 17 years from basically 2000 to last year.
Yeah. Wow. Now you had I know that you had an Airbnb at your property because I remember when you posted some pictures of that on Tiki Central.
Years ago. That's right. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, one of these days I want to stay in that Airbnb, but every time I go to Hawaii, I know I totally missed out. So
it was the number one Airbnb in the island.
Oh, you're kidding me. Was it really?
Yeah.
So what kept you really busy then?
So this is the deal. So living in Hawaii, so we moved to Hawaii in 2000. I'm like, I'm going to be a real artist. And so I wanted to like show in galleries and stuff like that. And Denise, she's a go-getter. She got a job as a coordinator at this kind of dot-com startup company in Honolulu. And I was getting into some galleries with my artwork. But it was like I had in my head the fantasy of what selling artwork in galleries was going to be, but the reality was not the same.
Yeah. That's usually how it is in anything. And the fantasy is always better than the reality.
Yeah, totally. Right. So I'm like, man, I don't know.
Like this whole podcasting thing.
Isn't it the life? Come on. You're just sitting around
like,
all day.
Oh, a lot of people think that, oh yeah, like all he does is just sit in bars with his friends and get drunk with microphones
so awesome.
On. It's like, I'm spending all my time editing and marketing and trying to figure out like how I'm gonna get paid.
Oh my God. That is so
I'm sorry
funny.
To interrupt
that
you,
is,
but yeah, I mean it's like
No, that's totally that is the being a creative person 100%. Like every creative field, it looks from the outside, it looks awesome. And they are awesome. I love what I do. But
yeah,
nobody knows that back end, that it's like 90% of the work is like the either the prep or the finishing work. And then 10% of the work is the fun stuff that people see, like, ooh, that's cool, you know?
Yeah, like what, like this conversation that we're recording right now is going to be the easiest part of this episode. The work yes. starts when we finish, and then I got to start editing, and I got to, you know, do all the work behind it. But But yeah, so you were saying you were making trying to make a go as an artist. And what kind of art were you doing?
So at that time, when I was in college and I was really into bronze casting, and so I thought I would get back into that and do. I thought it'd be cool to make really cool decorative hardware, like doorknobs and cool like latch pulls and drawer handles and stuff like that. So I was taking the work that I, you know, when I was living in Japan, I was I did a lot of wax carving, and so I was doing some really cool, just like octopus door handles and. Things like that. I'm like, these would be awesome. And I got into a bunch of galleries in Hawaii, and that was super great, but it was not as it wasn't as smooth sailing as I expected. Like, you know, it was difficult to track down gallery sales, and that got frustrating. It's just like, oh man, this is just, I'm not going to say that it was work. It just, because I mean, I like working. Working is fun, but it was frustrating for me. It wasn't as smooth as it could have been.
Yeah. So I mean, like, the first hard part is getting to the gallery. But then, I guess it sounds like you quickly realize that that's just the first step.
It is, yeah. And I'd get frustrated. I'd go into a gallery and I'd be like, "Where are my pieces?" And like, "Oh, they sold a couple months ago." I'm like, "Well, am I going to get paid?"
Exactly. So,
it just got weird.
You started, you were always a sculptor? So these door handles, you were sculpted them, it sounds like, they're an unusual shape or something different, right? Sounds like something that maybe that you sculpted or molded.
Totally, yeah. So I always loved monsters ever since I was a little kid. And I always wanted to work in Hollywood and make monsters. Like when I mean, it's the classic geeky Hollywood guy story of, I saw Star Wars, and then, like, there was, like, the Star Wars special effects specials that would be on, you know, like, on TV, and it would show the behind the scenes, and, like, that's when I clicked on me, like, oh my god, this is a job. Like, people do this for a living. That's what they do, is, you know, make models and monsters and blow stuff up. So it's like, that's what I want to do. I gotta do that.
Doesn't it look awesome? I mean, like, when I was a kid and I saw behind the scenes footage of, you know, the special effects guys making the models way that they would film. Like, I just thought, oh, that just looks like so much fun. It just looks like playtime.
Yeah, totally. So I'm like, I got to do that. So this was back, I graduated in 1990 from high school. And this is before the internet existed. And it was a different time back then. And so I did not know how one goes to school for that. To do that job, to make monsters. I didn't know what to do. And my college advisor at my high school was like, oh, I don't know what to do. You know, it was not a common, you know.
Right.
Whereas the weird thing is now there's all these schools that specifically teach just that. And it's weird. It's a different time. So I went to college with the closest thing that I could imagine getting. I just got a communications degree with a specializing in you know, photography and video. And then I basically lived in the sculpture studio and the art department. That's where I learned mold making and sculpting and stuff like that. The aggravating thing for me back then was they would not allow figurative sculpture. They thought that was beneath someone to do figurative sculpture. So I'm like, oh man. So I had to do all like this abstract stuff. I'm like, oh man,
you know,
how am I going to learn how to make monsters?
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that because, you know, I spoke with John Mulder recently.
Yes, yep.
He mentioned that one of his art instructors said, no tiki.
Yep.
But, yeah, and the same thing, I don't know if you heard the Bosco episode.
Yes, both of those episodes. That's why I'm a little nervous right now because you've had some pretty heavy hitters in the mug department.
Well, I've got a heavy hitter on the line right now. But I mean, what I find interesting is that the art school, it just seems to me that art schools shouldn't tell you what you can and can't do.
Was,
like, the, that's like saying that this is not art, right?
Yep.
And I always thought that art schools taught you to think outside of the box when you make your next creation.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to me that you're the third person who's told me that your art school restricted you on what you could and couldn't do.
Yeah, it was really frustrating. I was really interested in doing like portrait sculpture, like learning, you know, the anatomy of the human figure and stuff like that. It was just like a no-no. He's like, I remember my sculpture teacher who I loved dearly. I'm friends with him on Facebook. He was a super cool guy. He was pretty laid back about it, but he's definitely an abstract artist. And he said, like, he's like, the thing with figurative sculpture, he's like, you got to do it really good or you shouldn't do it. Like, you know, I'm like, something like that. I'm afraid I'm going to misquote him and he's going to listen to this and get upset. but I remember thinking at the time, like, well, how am I going to get really good at it if I don't practice it,
exactly.
you know, and do it? But I did learn how to make molds there, like a beginning mold making there, which gave me the foot in the door I needed to get into LA, which is the best thing I got out of that school just that mold making stuff.
And I've been told that mold making in itself is an art.
Oh my God, let me tell you, it is it's intense. It is an art and a science and a little bit of black magic, perhaps.
Okay.
There's a little something magical happens and I don't quite get it, but it's amazing when it all comes together. I thought, I'm like, oh, I know how to make molds after getting out of college. And I got to LA we got to LA. Denise, as I said, she's a go-getter, and she had a job lined up immediately. She started working immediately in LA. I sat around in my underwear unemployed for months, sending out, you know, reams of resumes and getting depressed, like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And finally I broke down. I'm like, oh, I've got to get a job doing something. So I was telemarketing for like a week.
Oh,
just
wow.
Miserable. Like, whoa, I'm like, what is this? This is horrible.
I've done telemarketing before and it sucks.
Oh, it was soul sucking. It was just like, oh man. And it was, I felt like it felt doubly evil because they were leveraging the fact that it was like an LA area code that we were calling out of, and it'd be like, hi, I'm calling you from Hollywood, California to find out what movies you're interested in. And people are like, really, Hollywood? I'm like, I'm such a skeezy person to be doing this.
So I got a call from, well, I shouldn't say I got a call from a guy. I actually called a guy because we, you know, we had an auto dialer, right? So after you hung up on a phone call, it automatically dialed the next person. And I got a guy that was like super friendly and really calm and patient and easygoing. And I said, and I thanked him, right? You know, I said, God, this has been probably the best phone call I've had all week. And I said, thank you for just talking to me like a human being. And he said, I answer phones for 911. So I know exactly what you're going through. It was like a bro moment.
You had the bond. You had that telephone bond.
Yeah. And you know what's actually funny is I was a telecom engineer before I got laid off and started doing this podcast. I was behind the scenes, right? I wasn't taking calls anymore. I was setting up all of the call routing and stuff. So anyway.
I can tell you, it was a bleak week for me. I was like, oh man, it's come to this. And a week into that job, a friend of a friend of a friend called and said, hey, you've been calling us, you know, daily for 3 months. It looks like we finally have a position. It's unpaid. And I'm like, I'll take it.
You just want to get your foot in the door, right?
Yeah. So totally. So it was a PA position on a Clive Barker film.
Okay.
And I was on cloud nine. And so then on that show, I got to be really good friends with the special effects artists on that film from KMVFX Group. And they hired me on that film, and it was so awesome. I actually got to go back on that same film that I started as an unpaid PA as a puppeteer for KMVFX. And it was super sweet.
Who was the guy that gave you a chance? Let's give him a shout out.
Oh, Howard Berger.
Howard Berger.
I love Howard. Howard was like, I consider him my like LA dad. Like he totally
Awesome.
Like picked me up out of that the kind of PA position. He saw I was working hard, and like he nurtured me. And I mean, I was a can be for my whole run in LA. I mean, occasionally I worked in other shops, but I love that guy. I love the crew. I mean, it was three partners that owned the company: Hardberger, Greg Nicotero, and Bob Kurtzman. And they're awesome. They do The Walking Dead now.
Yeah,
they're
I was
going to
say
the
Greg Nicotero from Walking Dead.
Yeah. So we did. It was a blast. It was super great working with him. But I thought that to go back to it, I'm like, I know how to make molds. So he's like, okay, well, let's get you back to the shop. We'll get you making some molds. Mm-hmm. And I walk in the shop and I like look at all the other molds. I'm like, I don't know anything about molds.
Wow. So there's different types.
It would be like the Wright brothers, like with their little airplane that they made out of like sticks and paper. Uh-huh. Like, yeah, we know how to make airplanes. And then they like see an F-15 roll up, like, oh yeah.
Well, these guys are industry. I mean, they've probably been doing it for so long, you know.
Oh yeah.
And they've got techniques that, you know, because when you're in school, truth be told, you're not always taught what the latest thing is.
Yeah, very true. Very true. You know? Yeah.
But
But it was, the cool thing was about that can-be at the time, and it probably still is just as cool, who knows. But they were super patient with me. Mm-hmm. It was a really supportive environment, and I learned a lot. It was like the best graduate school you could ever go to for sculpture, for just making any three-dimensional object. It was incredible. The level of talent over there, mm-hmm. in every department, it was a blast. It was super cool.
Now, did you do anything other than sculpture? Did you paint or anything like that?
I didn't do any sculpture over at Canby.
It was molding. Okay.
So, well, I was, I guess you could call me a lab monkey. I was a person of many hats. I started at Canby doing mold work. When they were slow, I was on their mold department. And I mean, I was not the best mold maker. I was an okay mold maker. I got okay, I guess. But I was doing mold work there. I was running parts, like you cast things. I was doing a lot of, like, they call it like a lab tech mm-hmm. shop monkey position, handling a lot of dangerous chemicals and doing things like that. Mm-hmm. Just the entry level position. I was there for a while. I eventually, a couple pluses I had for me was I'm not tall, but I'm 6 feet tall.
I was gonna say you're taller than me.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm of good height, and I was relatively thin at the time, mm-hmm. And so I would fit into monster suits. So they put me in monster suits in movies, and that was
how cool was that?
Yeah, so I got into the Screen Actors Guild, and I was able to perform in a lot of monster suits for films, and that was super good.
Okay, so now have to ask you. You have to tell me which monsters you were and in what movies, so that I can go and look at those. And I can point to you, and I can say to my kids, I know that guy.
Well, most of the films you probably couldn't watch with you. Well, your kids are older now.
Yeah, I've got a son in college now, so.
Okay. Well, From Dusk Till Dawn was my first big monster suit performance. Okay. I was in that movie. The character was called the Mouth Bitch, if I can use that language.
The Mouth Bitch.
But see,
I'm going to have to look that one up. Okay.
It's I'll send you a picture. It is absolutely horrifying. I'm like this super just nasty female vampire, and we like put a bunch of like lead shot into the breasts, so they were like extra pendulous, these horrible things. And
that, were you also one of these that would sit in a stool for hours getting makeup done, like, you know, that they'd be putting prosthetics and things like this on your face?
I've had that done. So the suits that I wore, fortunately, most of the suits I wore didn't involve a lot of that. The Mouth Bitch, that they did have to blend like the neck and the back. So once you were in, it's like there's no bathroom. You're right.
Right.
But then most of the suits I wore after that, I'd be like a bear. I'd wear like bear suits and things like that. Those are usually easier to get in and out of. But yeah, it is definitely, you've got to learn bladder control.
Do you ever get claustrophobic in some of these? Because when you said bear suit, that sounds claustrophobic to me.
So I did get a little notoriety for passing out on occasion.
Oh.
It's happened a handful of times. I blacked out during my life cast, which is horrible. Yeah. I have a really low pulse rate and low blood pressure. So... It happens, and it's not unusual, but it was funny. I, like, thank God I passed out during my life cast towards the end of it, so they could still get a good cast of my body cast. It's like, you know, they cover your entire body.
Right.
Yeah. So it's pretty. And I was in this really weird
stuff
pose.
So you could breathe, right?
Yeah, it's an ordeal. I mean, if I ever had to do that again, now they do like the laser body scanning, so no one has to go through that nightmare.
That sounds so much better, because I remember seeing something again, another behind the scenes video or something, and they did a body cast of somebody, and they did the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, like they're including their head and their face and all that.
Yeah.
And they said, I don't ever want to do that again.
It's taxing. So for me, usually like it can be. So I would do most of the live casting. I was part of the live casting group, the regulars, I guess. Uh-huh. And it is a taxing thing to do on somebody, because it takes a lot of time. Especially for the full body cast, you're covering someone with plaster, and then that plaster is getting rigid, so it gets restrictive. So breathing, you know what I mean? Like your mm-hmm. chest, it can freak some people out. And it gets very hot as that plaster kicks off. And so, you know, there's a heat, it's constricted, it's very strange.
Right.
The head casting, though, sometimes can be very almost zen-like in a way. Like you get this stuff put on you and it kind of muffles all hearing, and you're just going to get encased in this thing. And that's usually not quite as nightmarish as the full body cast can be, at least for me.
It still sounds bad. Like when you said that, like things get muffled. I mean, you know, I use this stuff, you know, to clean my ears. You know, the liquid that you tilt your head and you put the liquid in there just to clean your ears. And when my ears muffle, like when the sound just muffles out, I think, okay, how long do I have to lay here with the stuff in my ears? And it's only like 3 minutes, you know?
It's a much longer for the life cast. Although, I mean, this is back in the 90s, and so things have improved since then. Like, they've gotten, you know, they've gotten much better materials, and I guess it goes faster now. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it was an adventure. But it was fun, and that was my absolute favorite part of working in the film industry. Well, my two favorite things. Hanging out in the shop was always fun. It was a great crew, and the number one thing I miss about leaving L.A. is all the people that I got to work with at K&B. They were most funny, friendly, just talented group of people ever. I miss them.
Do you still talk to them at all?
I do. I'm friends with a lot of them on Facebook, and we chat. And the coolest thing, the year before last, or was it last year? God, time has lost all meaning with this move. I ran the Boston Marathon, and Howard Berger was up there, and Tammy Lane, both Academy Award winners.
How cool is that?
Doing that they were filming that movie, the Mark Wahlberg movie about the Boston Marathon bombing.
Right.
So I got to hang out with them. I'm like, oh my God, it was so cool to see him.
Yeah.
And then when I was living in Hawaii, they came out and shot Predators. I guess it was one of the last Predator movies made on the Big Island, and I got to fly out and spend a week hanging out with Greg and a bunch of the guys. It was so much fun.
Well, that's neat. Did they ever visit you when you were living in, where did you say you're living? Was it Kailua?
Oh, in Kailua. Kailua. Yeah. So actually, when they wrapped out that shoot on the Big Island, then one of my good friends, Jake, flew over and hung out with me for a while in Kailua. They shoot them all around Oahu.
That's cool.
Funny, not too many people visited, because you know what? In L.A., you work all the time, so there's no such thing as vacation.
I always had it on my list to do your the Airbnb that you had.
Yeah. Dude, you could have come. We would have made a mug in the studio. It would have been awesome.
Well, I never actually thought that you would leave Hawaii. I mean, that's... You know,
I know, right?
It's one of those things that, you know...
Well, neither did I.
Well, you know, because I guess Thor used to live there, and he left too, right? He had his own gallery there.
Yeah, he came out guns blazing. Like, he moved out there and, like, opened a gallery in Waikiki. I was like, dude, this guy is going all
in. Yeah, right
in
Waikiki.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you in part by Steadfast Pomade. Steadfast Pomade is a strong-holding, medium-bodied, water-based styling product for men and women, which leaves your hair looking slick, neat, and shiny with a clean, fresh scent. Its unique formula allows you to easily restyle your hair throughout the day and washes out with ease. Steadfast Pomade is American-made and veteran-owned. Available in original and anchor hold. Get yours today at steadfastpomade.com. Tame the waves and keep it steadfast. This episode is also sponsored by the Tiki Tea. Founded in 1961, the Tiki Tea is a family-owned and operated tropical drink bar practicing the lost art of exotic cocktail mixing. Come try their house specialty, the Ray's Mistake, a delicious concoction of botanic liqueurs, passion fruit, gin, and rum for only $6 on Wednesdays until 9 p.m. The Tiki Tea is located at 4427 Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, California. For more information, check out their website, tiki-ti.com. The Tiki Tea, Ground Zero for tropical drinks.
So how different is your lifestyle now compared to the way that it was in Hawaii?
It is night and day. It is weirdness, I gotta say. So, I mean, it's hard to say because it's been like a year of transition. So it's strange. But so Hawaii, living there, I lived in Kailua. You're familiar with the town, a little beach town.
So you're probably always in the water, right?
Okay, well, this is another thing. Like, not only do I not sound like I'm from Hawaii, but I didn't swim a lot.
Oh. Everybody that I know that lives in Hawaii walks around in shorts, slippers, and t-shirt. Or, like, I shouldn't say shorts, trunks. Trunks, yeah. Slippers, and t-shirt. That's it. Yeah, yeah. That's every day, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. I still wear that. I'm wearing it right now, and my wife thinks I'm crazy because it's like 50 outside.
Yeah. And then I go to like these Hawaiian reggae shows, and you know, you can tell the guys that are actually really from Hawaii because doesn't matter what the weather is, it's trunks, slippers,
yep, no shoes,
and, yeah, right. No shoes, and t-shirt or tank top, and yep. you know I'm buddies with Jordan T. I don't know if you know who that is. He's a Hawaiian musical artist from Maui, and that's all he wears. If you look at him on stage, it's all he wears is trunks. Yeah. And, you know, he wears trunks all the time.
That's the uniform.
That's the uniform. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's weird. So coming out here, like, so, okay, Hawaii, we live in that town. The house that we had, it was an old house. It's like built in like 48. That it was on a 5,000 square foot lot. Really tiny, tiny house, single wall construction. My neighbors were all right next to me. Mm-hmm. Like, you look out any window and I'd be looking in my neighbor's house.
Oh, wow.
So it was and I'm trying to run my business out of that, you know, as once I started making mugs, like the mug things, it slowly got ramped up and it started taking over more and more of what I was doing at the house. But a lot of ceramic stuff makes noise, you know, the kilns are noisy. And
How did you get started doing that? That just seems so different from, well, I guess you were doing mold making. I guess it's a natural transition, I suppose.
Start making tiki mugs now. Well, it was a total epiphany. It was that classic, like, you know, everyone's got that tiki moment of like discovering tiki, I guess.
And interesting that you say that because you were born and raised in Hawaii.
Isn't that weird? So This is the weird thing about my, I guess, tiki awakening, if you will, is it put a name on something that I remember from my childhood in Hawaii that had been slowly disappearing from Hawaii, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of just put a pin in it. Like, this is what it was. And it was like 2002, I think, or maybe 2001. I had pretty much given up on the gallery stuff. I mean, I was doing it part time or just on the side, but I had gotten a job at that same .com startup my wife was working at, and I was heading up an animation department there, doing animation for video game development. It was like, I can't believe I have this job in Hawaii. This is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Fun fact, it was ridiculous because after the kind of the .com bust, everyone got fired. We all lost the jobs. But it was for the best. It was for the best. Okay. But the cool thing was some people on my team they were on a different team. Some other artists there. They were doing these theme weeks. We'd all dress up every day of the week. It was a fun group of people. And one of the days, the theme was Exotica. I'm like, what is Exotica? I had no idea. I'm like, is this like are we dressing up as strippers? What is this? I don't know what this means. And like, dude, Exotica. And I go into their kind of section of the building, and they've got all like Martin Denny albums on the wall. I'm like, I don't know what any of this is. I'm like, okay, we're going to go to a concert. We're taking you to a concert. Meet us. There's a place called the Hawaiian Hut. And I think it was right in the Ala Moana Hotel.
Okay.
And that was the first tiki bar I ever went to. And we went to see a concert there by Don Tiki, first mm-hmm. Exotica band I ever heard. And my mind was blown because the Hawaiian, have you ever been there? Did you ever go before it vanished?
I've never been there, but I've seen Don Tiki perform a couple times.
Okay, so all right. So you know half of the magic then. I mean, those guys.
Oh, they're great.
And then the Hawaiian Hut was, it was an incredible place. Now, I never saw it with like the lights turned on, but it was it was a beautiful classic. I mean, I don't know if it was, you know, golden age, but it definitely was.
It had that old school kind of feel.
Oh yeah, I mean,
you're saying like did it
look
did it
exactly
feel like
La
Mariana, like something like that?
It did. It was well. I think it was even a better. I mean, La Mariana, which has a special place in my heart for always. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that place is kind of like a Frankenstein construction. It just kind of
sure, yeah.
So this place you could tell was built all at once. It was for the Ala Moana Hotel, which is a fancy hotel, you know, at the time back in when it was made in the 60s. So this thing was built out then, and it looked just like the Enchanted Tiki Room. I mean, it was thatched everywhere in bamboo. No surface was not covered with some form of woven fibers.
I'm going to have to Google this to see if there's anything online so I can see what you're
describing.
It was
a pretty sweet place. Now, I'm worried that my mind's eye is building it up better than it was.
Oh, yeah. It usually does.
It usually does. But it was cool. Well, let me tell you. So magical things happen. I get in there. I'm like, this place is awesome. I did not drink at that time. I was not a drinker.
Okay.
I'm like, I feel compelled to order a Mai Tai. And a tiki mug.
Right.
He was in a Hawaiian Hut mug, which I have to this day. It's one of my cherished mugs.
Yeah.
And like, it's part of my sad collection of mugs from bars that I've been to that are no longer with us.
Yeah.
Which is probably, everyone's got that sad shelf.
We've all got those. Yeah.
Yeah. But I took a sip of the Mai Tai, and it was, I mean, we won't go into, you know, the many levels of Mai Tais, but it was good.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at the mug, and I'm like, this is such an incredible thing. I'm like, it is functional art. It is a teleportation object. Holding and using this object, it takes me someplace other than where I am.
Yeah,
it's like to a better mindset, a fantastical place. It taps into the thing that my brother and I growing up in Hawaii felt like anytime we were hiking through the jungles and we'd find, you know, remnants of old, you know, Hawaiian taro fields or old just things in the jungle that have been covered, and that excitement and that adventure of that. And like, you know, we saw Indiana Jones when we were a kid, and we just hiked forever after that, like, oh my god. I mean, my brother, he's an archaeologist, he's got super
into
that too, so he has a huge love of that, of finding ancient things. It tapped into all of that for me, and I was like, I have got to make one of these. I have to do it. And I called up this art tutor that I had when I was like in fourth grade, because I knew she had a kiln in her house.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, Donna, can I come over to your house and make a tiki mug? She said, well, sure. And I did. I went over there and I made a tiki mug. I'm like, yes. And I was just hand sculpting, and just so these were like one-off mugs. And I did that for years. I was just making them over at her place for a while, and totally into it. Until my office was filled with tiki mugs, and then the house started getting filled with tiki mugs.
You know, when you first started posting your tiki mugs on Tiki Central many, many years ago.
Yes.
I have to say, I was blown away. They were so outside of the box from what we were accustomed to seeing. And you know, when you tell me about the monster stuff that you wanted to start doing, you know, early on in your career, or as a student, right? Now it makes sense to me when I look at the style of tiki mug that you make, because it was tiki, but it was different. So when I first saw it, I thought, what the actual fuck is this?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. No, it's weird stuff. I know, it's really weird. Like
big eyes, big teeth.
Yeah.
And then you said something what's the word I'm looking for here? And it made sense to me. That's you said one time, oh, I tried carving. And you said, yeah. I don't know how you guys do the takeaway thing. Because I do the exact opposite. And then when I looked at your stuff, I thought, oh, yeah, it's not carved the way, it's sculpted. It's not carved, right? So where you add the details instead of carving it out of the clay. And
yeah, you've got that whole like additive subtractive thing going on.
Yeah,
and
yeah. It never crossed my mind, because I always looked at it the same way that you would carve a log, right? Where
you
start with the cylinder and you remove the parts you don't want.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then I saw it, the way that you do it after you said that, it just never occurred to me before.
Yeah, it's totally different. I have total respect for people who carve, Tiki Diablo carved two unreal tikis for the new house that we're moving into, that we moved into last night. Oh my God.
Oh, did he really?
They're like featured in the main great room of the house.
Oh, how cool is that?
I haven't put them in yet. They're still in the garage. I'll be putting them in probably in the next week or two. We wanted to put something in the house that was just like, so the theme of the house, let's take it back. Let's take a step back. I, of course, Hawaii is always going to be in my heart. And so I wanted to take a lot. I mean, I still love tiki. The theme of the house, and we built a separate studio that's separate from the house, is the Van Tiki Lodge and the Van Tiki Ranger Station. So I picture that this house and studio are on Van Tiki Island, but up on the slopes of Mount Van Tiki, which is the big volcano at the center of the island. So it's a pretty high altitude thing. So think of like the volcano house on the big island.
Okay.
That kind of thing. But a little more national parky. So the house, we designed the house to look like a lodge, kind of a small lodge thing.
Man, and then the studio is supposed to look like.
And then so the house, we put a lot of tiki flair into it. Like I spent forever carving like my brains out with a router, all this stuff.
And right.
As you know, you'll spend like 2 weeks with a router, like, oh, I just did a mountain of stuff, and you put it in the house, and you're like, well, damn it, I covered like 1% of the walls.
I know. When I was building my Desert Oasis room, I just felt like I was routing forever, and then I'd put it up, and then I'd think, okay, now I need to put matching moldings around the windows. So then I'd route that, and then I thought, oh, now I need to match that to this wall. So then I'd route that, and I thought, oh, I should do it on the bar too, so the bar matches the room. And then I just got to the point where I thought, oh my God, I just don't want to route anything anymore. It's just so time consuming, and it takes so much out of you. Right.
It does.
Doing a house. So if you're doing a house, I can't imagine like how much work that is for you.
Well, it's pretty minimal. I mean, we just put a few pieces in there. We have like one wall that we kind of went gangbusters on, and we have a big shelf in there. But the cool thing is there's a loft in the house, and it has these two support poles that hold it up. And it's actually Denise, my wife and partner, who was like, we should totally get some really gorgeous tikis in here and build them into the house.
Yeah.
And I was looking through my Instagram feed, and of course I follow all the tiki folk like a rabid dog. I cannot stop looking at Instagram. And I saw those carvings that Danny did at that theater. Is it the Mission Theater?
Yeah, Mission Tiki Drive-In.
Yeah, so he had those ones that went around, they encased those poles, support poles.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, that's what we're doing. So I message him, he's like, I would love to do that. So these are going to surround these support poles, and they basically are, we have this big kitchen island, and they're going to sit bam right on top of it.
So I am probably as curious as our listeners. I'm sure everybody wants to see what you're doing. So you're eventually gonna have to post photos of this.
I post so on Instagram, if you look back in my feed, I did post some pictures.
Oh, they're okay.
Picking up. Yeah, we drove down to his place to pick up the tikis. It was when we went down for Caliente.
So I'm going to have to go look at your Instagram then.
Yeah, you got to
do some sleuthing and just go back.
But I'll definitely, when I put him in the house, I'll be definitely posting some current photos for sure. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and they are very heavy. It's so funny. Like, talk about the difference between carving. This is the difference between carving and ceramics. Like, moving my stuff around, I'm always like, careful, careful.
Right.
And I go to pick him up, and Danny like throws it in the bed of his truck. He's like, come on, man, it's not clay. Boom. And he just throws it. I'm like, dude, careful. He's like, it's wood. It's fine. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, nothing's going to happen to a big log, right?
Yeah, but I'm like, and it's funny, like, I drove down there with like 20. Like furniture pads and foam and all this stuff. He's like, what do you got all that for? I'm like, to protect the tikis. He's like, dude,
yeah,
throw it in your car and it'll be fine.
Oh, that's funny. So is it safe for me to assume that you're still doing tiki stuff now that you're in Oregon?
Oh yeah. Oh, so here's the deal. So we moved, you're like, this is many paths of the conversation will come together eventually.
That's fine. Take your time.
You're like, why did we move? So we were living in Hawaii, and living in Hawaii is very expensive. The cost of living there is just insane. And so it was, every month was like white knuckles for us of making our mortgage payment, of just getting all the bills paid. And when that company folded, back after the 9/11 thing, you know, and then the kind of the dot-com crash happened, we started our own business. And so I was doing illustration and design work and animation work for TV commercials and video game design and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we were doing okay. But then, you know, the recession happened, and it was stressful. It was stressful times.
Even with the Airbnb,
we built it. We built the Airbnb because of that. Like, you know what? We need to supplement our income. I mean, that's in Hawaii. It's like keeping all those little pots stirring to you know, make money.
Well, like, that tells you something if, like, I mean, like, your jobs and an Airbnb, that's the number one Airbnb in Hawaii, you've still, like you said, white knuckle every month.
White knuckle.
Right? Yeah. That speaks to that situation. You know, someone mentioned one time that, and it was a local guy. He says, you know, a lot of us work at these resorts because it's a tourist-based economy.
Yeah.
And so many people make minimum wage. And it's like one of the most expensive places to live in the world. And so many of us make minimum wage, you know?
I fear for Hawaii in my heart because it's not a sustainable path for me.
Yes.
And that's why I kind of left. I'm like, it was a lot of stress for us. And so, and over the years, you know, our tiki business was doing really well. I was, you know, like, it's funny, I was doing like computer work versus tiki work. It used to be like 80% computer work, 20% tiki work. And slowly, like, the scales started shifting over the last 4 or 5 years to where tiki started to eclipse my computer work.
Oh,
and,
wow.
But the catch is, tiki is expensive to do in Hawaii because everything I got to ship to Hawaii and then ship it back to the mainland.
Okay.
And also, kilns are expensive to run. Like, it's just, there's a big overhead cost.
Yeah.
And so we started doing the math. I'm like, what if we were running this business somewhere, not on an island in the sea?
And you picked a good spot. You picked, Oregon, it's still at the moment reasonably priced, you know, although it's starting to get really popular.
It is getting popular. And it's weird. Even the area we moved to, Eugene, and the prices here have gone way up since I'm glad we bought when we did. And
yeah,
we got a pretty magical spot. I hope you can come and visit someday. I'd love to. TikiCon. Haven't been to TikiCon?
I haven't been to TikiCon. You know, I was supposed to go this year. My sponsor, Tandawai Rum, was going to send me up there. Last minute, you know, there was an adjustment to the budget, and I ended up not being able to go. But yeah, I've been wanting to go. You know, the last job that I was at, I worked at a software company, and we had an office up there, and so I've been to the Portland area before. It was in Beaverton, I don't know how close that is to where you are, but it's just so beautiful, that area over where I don't know what they call it because I'm not local, where the bridges are over by the river, you know.
I'm
driving past that to the office, and I'm thinking, wow, it's so nice up here. You know, the air feels so much cleaner. And
the air is so clean. It's insane.
It's beautiful. Everything's green.
Yeah,
you know, like, here in Southern California, you know how it is. You've been to Southern California many times. It's a desert, it's a struggle to keep the grass green here. Especially when we're trying to be conservative with our water, you know.
Right.
But
you know, yeah, I'll get up there one of these days and I'll bug you
for a studio
tour.
Well, if you make it out to TikiCon next year, yeah. It would be cool. If you come up for TikiCon, you can come in town and visit us in Eugene and you can hang out.
I would love that. I would love that. Thank you for the invitation. Yeah. Yeah, I would love that. So what are you working on right now?
Well, we are... the house is sucking up all time, like this big black hole of time, sucking energy. Oh, my God. So I feel super backlogged. It's been a crazy year, as I've mentioned many times. my brother and his wife were super awesome when we moved out here to let me set up in their garage. And
nice of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's got a 2-car garage. I got half of it and I got to set up. So I set up my kiln, like I wired my kiln in there. And so last winter I started making mugs here in Oregon in his garage, in his, I will say, unheated garage. So that was a big like, what?
So how different is it when you're making mugs in the Pacific Northwest versus in the Pacific Ocean? Because like the humidity is different, and so everything dries different and sets differently, right?
Everything I knew, just throw it out the window because it doesn't work anymore.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, so like my molds are behaving totally differently because, I mean, it's humid in Hawaii, obviously, but not like it is here. I mean, we had rain for like 120 days straight or something like that.
Wow.
Last winter was one of the wettest, weirdest winters they've had ever. So it was damp, to say the least. You know?
Yeah, that's going to affect all your mold. And it
affected the molds. And then the temperature, the temperature really threw me for a loop. I lost a lot of work, which I hate to say, but... But ceramics is a cold, hard teacher.
Yeah.
It's a path to fail world in ceramics.
Of your ceramics, when you're making mugs and you go into production, let's just say like you do 20, of the 20, how many of them actually make it through to the end? How much loss or shrinkage do you have?
That's a good question. It depends. So when I left Hawaii, I was like on a perfect 2020. Like if I would make stuff,
awesome.
It would all survive. But it took me a while to get there. Like it took me a while. Like at the get go, I was losing. I wouldn't lose. The thing is, so you do tests and things like that, and you get to a point. The thing that is hard is when it happens bad. At least for me, you'll think you got it all dialed in the open the kiln, and everything in the kiln is dead.
Oh, that's a bummer. And here's the thing. You can't check on the kiln, right? You have to wait.
There's no... I keep on saying someday I'm going to invent the kiln camera. It's like a little GoPro. Right. It just sits inside of there. I can just like...
But it'll probably melt. It'll melt that camera, right? Because how hot does it get in there? Like 800 degrees, right?
It's like 2,000 degrees.
Oh, 2,000. So it's way hotter than a conventional oven. And that's the thing is that you can't open a kiln... away. You'll ruin the batch if you do that. So you can't check on it. You just have to wait until
it's
the right time to open it.
Yep.
And then when you open it and you've got a whole bad batch, that's got to be heartbreaking.
Oh, it was tough. So we came out here, we committed to do mugs for the Shameful Tiki Room. That was our first mug that we produced out here. And I'm like, all right, this is going to kick me in the pants to get me doing mugs out here. I'll take this job. And I started doing them, and immediately I had to change everything. So one, it was freezing cold in the studio. I was changing my clay body to I couldn't get the slip that I used in Hawaii. I was using slip formulated here. I was making my own slip from scratch, which I'd never done before.
Oh, wow.
All this stuff. And it was the first kiln load I opened it up. I'm like, these are all ruined. What have I done?
So what happens to that stuff? Do you just throw it away?
I throw it away while crying. And
I know that Bosco, he uses them in his garden. You know, when
it's funny. And I was just thinking about your podcast today because, you know, we're moving from my brother's little spare bedroom over to our place, and I'm throwing mugs away left and right.
Oh, no.
I'm looking right now at like 3 diver mugs that have little cracks in their feet. I'm like, no, throw them away.
Oh, no. Oh, well, you got to think of me when you're doing that.
I know, right?
I told that to Bosco, and I told that to John Mulder, too. And I said, hey, you know, like, if you ever feel like throwing something away, think of me first.
Well, here, you know, I would give them away all the time. But then, interesting thing. So And actually, John Mulder touched on this. You know, ceramics is forever. And yeah,
he said something that I'd never thought about, where he said, you know, this thing could be around for hundreds of years, like a couple hundred years from now, somebody could have this, and it could be an heirloom to them because it was handed down from a family member to a family member to a family member.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, how cool is that? And it's something that you made, right?
Exactly. And I think about that all the time. So that's why I'm pretty meticulous. I like to date. I put dates on my stuff as much as I can, because I wanted to have that timestamp. So when people look at this, you know, hopefully in many, many years, they go, oh yeah, this is from that time or whatever. But another artist that I listen to all the time, he's got a great podcast, The Potter's Cast, to plug it.
Let's give him a plug.
Paul, he runs this thing called The Potter's Cast. And he made this amazing point as an artist that really made me think. He said, you know, when you give away seconds like that, in 50 years from now, that piece will not be owned by that person, it'll be owned by somebody else. And someone will pick it up and go and look at the bottom and be like, oh, Van Tiki, look at this big crack in these bubbles. This guy didn't know what he was doing. Yeah. And there won't be any more context to know that that was a second or, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it made me think. So, I mean, this is just something. So he's like, you know, the artist that he was talking to said, I don't do that because I'm worried about my, you know, how I'm perceived.
Your legacy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, that does that. There's a lot of validity to that.
Yeah, there sure is. It's, you know, for a non-artist like me, it's something that I would have never thought of.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I never thought of it. But I mean, then I'm like, do I really care? I'll be dead at that time too. I mean, the funny thing is I like, I'm pretty bad about hanging on to all this stuff. Like I've got three diver mugs right here that I've just had on my desk forever. I'm like, do I need to have these mugs on my desk? I don't, but I have a hard time letting them go. Sometimes it's cathartic to let it go. Like if you have a bad glaze batch, it feels good to just break them all in the bottom of the trash can. Like,
you
know, that's like a sacrifice to the kiln god. Like, take these, take no more. You've had enough.
It's like karma. I'll sacrifice these for a really awesome batch in the future.
And let me tell you, my favorite thing in the world is destroying molds. Like when I'm done with a run on a mug, it feels so good to just destroy that mold. Yeah, because it's like, I mean, I love everything I make, but you know what I mean? When you make a lot of something, you just like, okay, can we do something?
Yeah, you're tired of looking at it.
Yeah, right? So it just feels so great to break up that mold.
And it's not special to you anymore, even though it's special to everybody else that's getting it. You know, the thing is weird is that by the time they get it, you've looked at it so many times.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, I'm terrible. Like, all I do is I look for mistakes on the thing. Like,
right.
But I mean, the funny, like, I'll post videos of me destroying molds and people get like upset.
Yeah.
Well, why are you doing that? You know, in case you might need it. But I'm like, dude, don't you understand? This is your protection. Like, I'm saying this is an edition of 100. You should be happy on destroying that mold, because then you know for sure.
Then then you know that you're not making something on the side and you know, cheating them out of something, right?
Yeah. But I mean, it's funny the comments that people will say. Just like I remember I posted me breaking a mold once, and then we had a hurricane come through in Hawaii, and I had a bunch I do tiles too, and I was pressing tiles, and every time I had a bag tile, I'd hang it out on the wall by the bed and breakfast. Mm-hmm. And the hurricane blew a bunch of tiles off the wall and they all broke on the ground. And somebody commented, like, bet you didn't wish you broke that mold now, huh? You know, like, like, no, man, it's okay. This tile broke.
Right.
It was so funny.
Man, I had forgotten that you did those tiles.
I love tiles.
A confession to make to you, Henrik. I don't have any Van Tiki mugs at all.
I'm going to end this interview right now.
Well, here's the thing. I've been collecting for so long, a couple decades.
And I know.
I'm so used to paying so little for my mugs. It's so hard for me to pay market price. And I
completely understand.
I don't argue that that artists deserve that, because I believe, in all honesty, and, you know, maybe people are going to think this is blasphemy for me, but I've tried my hand at trying to make mugs myself, right? As a tiki collector, I think every collector is all, you know, it's crossed their mind, like, you know, I should try to make one of these. And when I see how much work...
I think everyone should try, yeah.
Oh, yeah. When I see how much work there is behind every step of the process, from the sculpting to the molding to the glazing to the firing to, I mean, everything. And then you guys, like, sell it for, you know, $75, $85. Yeah, bucks. Yeah. I think to myself, that's underpriced. I mean, like, as a collector, it's still a lot of money. But, you know, from the other side of the coin... I think, wow, after all that work, I'm going to get like $75, you know?
Yeah. Well,
So, I know that collectors are probably going to curse me now, but I've seen both sides. And, you know, as somebody that is used to paying less money, I don't at all think that it's not worth what you guys are charging. It's just that, you know, when you're collecting stuff and every time you, every piece you buy is like $100.
It's just so expensive. I love tiki mugs, but I have a shamefully small tiki mug collection because I can't afford tiki mugs.
Exactly. That's the thing, you know. So,
I'm super selective and
stuff's just amazing, you know, like when you, like I said, when your stuff first came on to Tiki Central and I started seeing it in people's collections, I thought, holy moly, this thing is huge.
Yeah. And I love big mugs. My wife all the time is like, take it down a notch.
She's like,
how about fewer teeth and a smaller mug, please?
That's like, the personality of your style, right? So so you can't do that. I mean, that's what a Van Tiki mug is.
I started making just the hand-built mugs, and I loved doing that. But I backed away from them while we were in Hawaii because two things. One, when one fails in a kiln, that's the only one.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and you put a lot of time into a hand built mug, a lot more than you do into a slip cast mug. So one, even when I was getting, I thought that they were selling well, and I was really happy with it. Still, I put a lot of hours into those mugs. You know what I mean? So there was that, and then when they would fail in the kiln, it would just be devastating because you'd lose like a week of work, on that one piece. Yeah. You know, so I switched out of that. And then two, it's easier to make them big when they're hand built than it is to make them small, for me at least.
But now
that we're back here, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and then they really stand out on a shelf with a bunch of other mugs. You know, I mean, like they're really pronounced, right? So, So
I like a big mug. I call me crazy.
Yeah.
But now that we're back here in, I've got a bigger kiln now, and, I totally want to get back into hand-built mugs. I want to start making them again, cause I love doing them. It's a whole different challenge. Like the plus side of the hand-built mugs for me is I don't have to worry about undercuts. You know what I mean? Like that's the whole
sure.
thing.
Yeah.
You know, you have to sculpt a special way for molded mugs.
And for the people that are not familiar with undercuts, do you want to explain that? Because I know, here's what I'll say, is if you sculpt a mug or any kind of piece of art in such a way that when you try to mold it, you can't pull the mold off smoothly. Those are undercuts, right? You have, these are ledges and corners and
things. Any shape that wraps around.
That wraps around so that,
like a,
into some kind of a piece that hangs over so that you can't mold it properly and pull the mold off smoothly. Does that work?
That's a very good description. And you can, people out there, take a mug off of your shelf. And if you eyeball this mug closely, it's always fun for me to play find the seam line.
Find the undercut? Find the seam.
The seam line. Because you can look at, if you look really carefully, you can see where the mold seams were most of the time. And it's interesting to see how they piece that mold together so that they could pull the mold directly off of the casting without, you know, damaging the clay and avoiding undercuts, avoiding areas that would kind of scoop under and would, you know, damage the mug as you demold it.
Right.
So that's the plus side of hand building mugs. The downside of hand building mugs is they have to be self-supportive when they're wet clay. So it's almost like an architectural challenge. Of you are working with mud and it has to hold its own weight while it's wet, and it has to dry uniformly. And then when it's firing, it also has to hold its own weight, because when the clay is in its firing state, it can slump or change.
This sounds very challenging now.
When I was handling mugs, I'm like, well, I don't have to worry about any cuts. I can do whatever I want. I'm like, well, no, actually, I got a lot of, just a whole new bag of challenges.
Right.
And then I was like, let me try slip casting a few, because then it would be nice, you know, when one fails that I have a mold and I can cast it again.
Just make a bunch of coconuts. There's no undercuts on that. And if they come out lopsided, exactly, that's how coconuts are in real life anyway.
But see, everyone does a coconut. And I'm like, I want to do, there's mugs that mug makers make.
Uh-huh.
And I love these mugs. It's like the quintessential tiki mugs. Like, everyone does a barrel,
right?
Coconut,
right,
is like a good example. And like, I want to do one. Like, I love how every tiki mug maker has their own spin on it. So I someday want to tackle one of those, kind of like the cornerstones of classic mugs.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of your mind from that, because you, obviously, like I've said before, your designs are outside the box. So it'll be interesting to see what you come up with.
I've started sculpting again. I'm stoked. I have a new Poi Pounder. I did a Poi Pounder last year. A Poi Pounder is a, are you familiar with a Poi Pounder?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I did one last year as a mug, and I love it. It feels so good in the hand. It's, you know, it's a Polynesian tool. I mean, it's designed as a hand tool, so it works perfectly as a mug, because it just feels so great in your hand. So I did it last year, and I was like, I'm going to make one of these every year. So I started this year's design a couple weeks ago, and it's ready to mold, and I'm super, super stoked about it. I have a backlog. I have like on my phone, I have like, you know, little notes app.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's just called Mug Ideas, and it's the list has gotten long.
Yeah.
But I have a couple that I totally want to jump on before the end of this year, because this year is ending quickly.
Yeah. Time is flying for sure for this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know that you are in the middle of moving right now. And your wife and your brother.
Don't make me go out there and help them.
they're probably cursing me right now.
Oh, my God. I was like, sorry, guys. I had to get to the thing. Like,
But before we wrap this up, what's the future of Van Tiki?
Well, I'm super stoked about, well, I have mugs. I'll be getting some new mug designs out. And one of the things I'm more excited about, since we've actually moved to this big crazy place called the mainland, is we can go to more events. So I'm super, super stoked about that. We were hoping to go to Oasis this year, but it sold out in like a nanosecond.
Right.
But you know, we were able to go to Caliente, went to Mod Palm Springs last year. We can definitely go to TikiCon, and I'm just super stoked about that. We're hoping to go to Hukilau. So yeah, hopefully you'll see me at an event. I'll be the guy with, you know, some sort of crazy tiki pendant on.
And how often do you get down to Southern California? Because if you, the next time you're down here, if you've got the time, I'd love to host you guys at the Desert Oasis Room.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
Make you a drink or two.
Oh, I would totally love that. I'll bring you a bunch of second mugs.
Oh yeah, there you go.
Bring a wheelbarrow full of them down there. Here you go.
You don't have to. That wasn't why I was offering, but I won't say no.
As long as you write on them, this was a bad mug.
Yeah, there you go. Is there anything I can promote for you? Do you have a website?
Well, on my website, vantiki.com, which I haven't updated lately, but I'm most current on Instagram and Instagram and Facebook.
Okay.
I have just at Van Tiki. I try to be really good about posting sale dates and things like that, and things taking shape in the studio as they come along.
Very cool. Awesome. So,
and I hope that you can visit someday. It would be super cool. And if you see me at an event, I feel like I should say this. I'm a super shy guy as a rule. Like,
okay.
I've gone to always, like, I actually saw you doing the podcast at Caliente. I'm like, oh, he's doing the podcast.
Oh, but awesome.
I'm very, I'm super shy. So, and like, it's funny, like I, you know, I was in Hawaii when this whole thing, when I got into Tiki, and I look at Tiki Central and I see all like the, you know, the superstars of Tiki, and I went to my first Oasis, and it's very overwhelming. I'm like, oh my God, there's the people.
It is because, and then there's a lot of cliques out there. There's a lot of groups that have been established for many, many years, and it's hard to feel comfortable around some of those relationships. But, you know, the truth is that for the most part, the tiki community is just so open and friendly that...
Oh, that's the best thing. There's so much aloha.
Yeah, you just got to say hello. And, you know, no one's going to say, who are you? I mean, they're going to say, hi, what's your name?
Yeah.
You know?
So I'm getting better at that. My first tiki event I went to, I was just so shy. I'm like, I don't know what to do. Yeah. But I'm slowly getting better at, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, next time that we're in the same place at the same time, we'll make sure to have a drink together.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. And as far as superstars of tiki are concerned, I would argue that you're one of them because your stuff is just stellar. It is stellar.
Well,
everybody knows who you are. Everybody knows your work. And I've never heard anything negative about it at all.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And if you're ever in, I'll say this. I should say people, when I lived in Hawaii, always were wanting to visit the studio. They'd be like, hey, can I come see the studio? And I always would say no because the studio in Hawaii was a corner of my laundry room.
Oh, yeah.
But now I actually have a studio that you can visit. If you find yourself in the Eugene area and you want to see how tiki mugs are made, don't hesitate to, you know,
drop me a
message on Instagram and you can check out the studio.
There you go. I'm going to make sure that I do that next time I'm in the area then.
Yeah, I'm super stoked to actually have a space that I can show people and it's not filled with my dirty clothes.
Very cool. Well, Henrik, thank you again so much for taking the time to sit down and have a conversation with the podcast. I look forward to hanging out with you next time, whether I'm up there or you're down here. And I'm sorry you have to spend the rest of your day moving furniture.
Ah, so am I, but the end result makes it worth it.
And for our listeners out there, if you have any questions, comments, or just want to leave a shout out, check us out on Facebook. Find our group page Inside the Desert Oasis Room or follow us on Instagram at Polynesian Pop. Cheers and aloha.
Mahalo.
Mahalo.
Aloha.